The economy is crumbling. They say it's at its day. The workers are all rumbling. Revolution's on the way. But I could never be a Marxist. It goes against the grain. And before you call me past it, give me a chance to explain. You say, come up to Courtney Newell. He went with Danny Baker. So you silly disco songs and reading Melody Maker. I see him down at Dunkout.
Welcome to Radical, a podcast about the radical aspects of politics, music and football. I'm your host, Cas Mudde. My guest today is the US singer-songwriter David Lowery. David has a decades-long history in music and is probably best known as frontman of bands like Kemper Van Beethoven and Cracker. Less known, he has been teaching courses on the music business in the Terry College of Business at the University of Georgia, where I also work. In recent years, David has also been a tireless activist for the rights of musicians and a fighter against streaming companies. He's currently involved in a court case against Spotify. Welcome to the podcast, David.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Cas.
So let's start with my introductory questions. What was the first sports team you ever supported?
Well, we moved to California in the late 60s, early 70s. And so the local team was the Los Angeles Dodgers. Actually, it's almost like a cult religion with my siblings, my sisters. So even if I wanted to change teams, I wouldn't be allowed. So Los Angeles Dodgers.
Second, what is your favorite political song?
Well, I don't know if I have a song, but there's an album by Bruce Springsteen that has a number of songs on it. The album is called The Ghost of Tom Joad, of course, referencing the main character in Grapes of Wrath. It's largely centered on the Southwest and various immigrants from Texas to San Diego and the San Joaquin Valley. So I guess songs like The Ghost of Tom Joad, Sinaloa Cowboys, The Line, referring to the border. And the interesting song, Galveston, which is about the Vietnamese immigrants in the 80s and the local hostility they got from the local fishermen when they sort of came to the United States and started shrimp fishing. It's interesting. It's like a blue-collar sort of anti-nativist populism in that record, which might fit my politics pretty well.
Which is something we will definitely talk about later. Finally, what is your favorite political book?
I think there's two books that are pretty influential on me, and I don't feel like I agree with either author, but they were very engaging. And the first book is What's Wrong with Kansas? And the second book would be Hillbilly Elegy. Mm-hmm. They both kind of concern sort of the politics of sort of the white working class in the United States. They're both interesting.
So before we talk about the music business and your fight for artists' rights, I want to talk a bit about your music and particularly about the role of politics in your music. Do you consider your music to be political?
I feel like in a way it's apolitical. I often deal with politics in the music, but I often have characters with very different political viewpoints in the songs. The last Cracker album, Berkeley to Bakersfield, is ostensibly sort of divides the state east and west. So you sort of accidentally get sort of more left-wing voices on the first disc, which is the Berkeley disc, the Coastal California. And although it's not as apparent on the second disc, which is the Bakersfield disc, you assume some of the characters probably have more of a right viewpoint, especially the character who's speaking in the song, King of Bakersfield. He calls himself a Red State Union man. So yeah, I do have politics in the records always, but I like to invent characters and have them speak, and I like to play my characters sympathetically, generally, and allow the listener to come to their own judgments on it. But I try not to necessarily insert any political viewpoint in the overall narrative, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So you grew up in California, but not the California everyone thinks about, but the Redlands, which are more inwards, and which you have called, and I quote, the real California.
Right.
How has that shaped your music?
Well, a little bit on that, where I grew up in this area called the Inland Empire, which is probably begins about 70 miles east of downtown Los Angeles. And these are the high, dry valleys and the desert of California. That was a long time ago. I probably called that the real California. I would probably be a little more careful with my language. What I mean is the non-Hollywood, non-Silicon Valley parts of California, which is sort of what California is largely identified with in the popular imagination. This is kind of the part of California that might share a lot more similarities with the rest of the country. When I say sort of the rest of the United States, I don't mean that in a nativist way, because the Inland Empire is actually incredibly diverse. It's the most culturally diverse region and sort of ethnically diverse region of the country I've ever lived in. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of Latino culture there, both families that have been in California since it was part of Spain and more recent immigrants. But the region actually is home to immigrants all over the world. In the 70s, you had a lot of people from Southeast Asia come in, Vietnamese people, Cambodian people, and a lot of Hmong. On my street where I grew up, there were also a number of Egyptian Coptics, Levantine Christians from the Middle East, like from Lebanon and Syria, a number of Sikh families, Iranian Jews. I mean, if there's sort of the idea of the American melting pot, which, you know, that's a phrase that's no longer in fashion, but this was it, you know. It's a really interesting place to grow up, and it's only become more diverse.
So I guess this gels well with something you also said is, in a quote, you want to be in a place that is real so that when you make music, it engages with real people.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds quite populist, but as you said before, it is explicitly non-nativist. What makes such an incredibly diverse area that you grew up in a real place?
Well, I guess is more the way that people live their lives, but also sort of the culture that they consume, right? Even though I grew up in sort of a subculture of punk rock and neo-surf, so the culture that was kind of consumed in these regions was kind of more lowbrow. And I don't necessarily mean that in a bad way. Like, I liked sort of esoteric punk rock, but me and my bandmates in Camper Van Beethoven and Cracker, some of them came from the same region, we also enjoyed, like, traditional country music. And then the other radio we considered lowbrow in Latin culture was Norteño. These are the two main themes that we heard outside of rock music, right? The two main styles of music that we heard outside of that. We enjoyed that. Sometimes we were consuming that music or playing with those styles in kind of an ironic fashion, but there was also sort of a loving, you know, if we were kind of parodying or playing with that music, it was in a loving way, right? Not a dismissive sort of way.
So I also have a few questions about names of bands and songs. So both band names intrigue me, and I know you must have heard this 1,000 times. But please humor me. Why Camper Van Beethoven? And second, was the name Cracker chosen because of its double meaning? Because Cracker is also slang for white Southerner.
Yeah. I'll start with Camper Van Beethoven first, because then that better explains the name Cracker. So Camper Van Beethoven was sort of purposely designed to not really mean anything, although over the years, people have put different interpretations on it. We wanted it to not make sense, like sort of imply any assumptions on what kind of a music we were going to play. Whereas it was the opposite of like our other bands, which were kind of punk rock bands, and the names implied what you were going to hear. And even though, in a way, over the years, I think people have taken, you know, that sort of Camper Van and then Beethoven to sort of mean that, you know, sort of a lowbrow take on high culture, which maybe in some ways we were. That was not our intention, and that was accidental. Camper Van Beethoven very much became sort of a college favorite, and much of our takes on music were sort of, in a way, they're like regarded as like cultural criticism of the music that was around us, right? And so in a way, it had a way of acting as almost kind of highbrow culture, even though, because we're sort of reassembling lowbrow culture, in Camper Van Beethoven. So it fits very well with sort of, in the very broadest sense of the word, postmodernism. Whereas Cracker came along, and it's like we threw out some of the insincerity and threw out some of the postmodernism and said, well, no, 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 we actually really like this kind of music. And a lot of the music that we are incorporating here is associated with the South. And my father was from the South, from Arkansas. I was born in Texas. And so in a winking way, we're distinguishing ourselves from Camper Van Beethoven by making reference to sort of this non-elite white working class.
As a former skinhead, I have to ask you about the Camper Van Beethoven song, Take the Skinheads Bowling. Where did that come from? Why the reference to skinheads?
Well, the punk rock scene in California, let's just put it this way, it seemed to be divided between skinheads and more political punk rockers. And what we sort of noticed when Camper was first starting, we would play these punk tunes, a lot of punk covers, you like sort of in country styles or folk styles. And this seemed to create some puzzled, even hostile looks from the skinhead half of the crowds. And so we would always switch to a ska tune, which the skinheads always embraced in California and, of course, in the UK and in Europe and stuff like that. Because we spent a lot of time opening for straight up punk bands, right? We would switch to these ska tunes, and then the skinheads would be happy for another three or four songs with us. And so we had this relationship with the audience where we would almost use those ska tunes sort of defensively as like, hey, we're not making fun of you. Here's some music for you. And so that evolved to where basically, I don't know, we made this absurdist song that it's not supposed to mean anything. It doesn't say anything about skinheads. We just use the name in there. I don't know. It's kind of our comment on us having to do this, but we didn't really want the song to mean anything.
Right. So there is this excellent documentary that was made about you, I think, in 2016, and it's called Get Off This. It's available on YouTube, or at least it was, but it was never properly released. What happened?
Well, it may eventually get properly released, but at the time they tried to release it, the filmmakers, like even with me waiving my fee for my share of those recordings and compositions, it was still too expensive to license the songs properly. So what the filmmakers basically ended up doing was basically just sort of tacitly releasing it on YouTube, where it exists in a kind of gray world.
Right. So there were a few things in it that I found really interesting. In the documentary, you often refer to white when you talk about music of Cracker. And you also say that you figured out what white people were about, namely angst. What is this white angst or fear you refer to, and do you see a relationship to U.S. politics here?
That was so long ago. I don't know exactly what I'm talking about, but something that I've always been aware of for a long time. At some point, the part of popular music that's identified with sort of considered basically white styles of music, rock and all of its subgenres, punk rock, post-punk, indie, and metal, have since the 70s, not all songs, but a lot of them have had a kind of very dark, alienated sort of view on the world. And I think it really began with some of the space rock bands like Pink Floyd. The characters in the songs are kind of really alienated from society, you know, or socially or politically. I don't know. It just seems that that is one of the main themes that goes through all of these forms of music. You really see it in a lot of metal, too. So I think that's what I'm referencing, is that so much of like the music that I grew up on and then was sort of close to, there are songs about alienation. I mean, grunge is nothing but that in a way.
And what makes that white for you?
Well, I mean, just because those forms of music are associated with white culture as opposed to other stuff that I'm listening to. I don't mean that in a good or bad way. I mean that completely neutrally. There's no nativist comment there. I'm just saying that the music that the white teenagers listen to have a lot of that alienation in it.
Right. And to a certain extent, I mean, being both in Athens at the moment, a lot in the indie music, of course, in REM and that kind of college rock was also very much about angst. I think what's so interesting is that most people refer to it simply as angst, even though these musics were very white, but very few people would actually say that it was specifically white angst because the majority is white. And so
right.
When we speak about angst, we just assume that everyone shares the same angst as these white people.
Right. But that gets to something that I guess is peculiar for me and my friends is in some ways we were sort of self-aware of that, like that white people tend to think of themselves as the normal people, right? So if there's a Cartesian grid, we're at the origin, we're at the 00, right? But globally, I mean, my father was in the Air Force. I lived all over the world. That's not correct. And viewing yourself as the normal people, that's actually the root of all sort of, you know, racism and bias, especially unconscious bias, right? I thought actually that Camper Van Beethoven's awareness of that and Cracker's awareness of that was actually trying to undo some of the biases that we have.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. So in addition to a musician, you're also a lecturer in the business school here at UGA. What motivated you to start this, I assume, side career?
Yeah, it was kind of a side career. Well, let me just say one thing is unless you're a really popular musician with a popular band and playing probably theaters and above, most musicians are part-time in that you will see that the successful, long-lived sort of middle-class or niche artists or niche artists, often their ensembles are part-time in that you will also do things like audio engineering or producing, or you might be a side musician, a for-hire musician, or you might co-write with bigger stars. And so it's a series of part-time jobs in the music business. And so by the mid-2000s, I had assembled a good collection of part-time jobs. I was in Cracker. I was in Camper Van Beethoven. I produced records. I owned a studio complex. And I also had a joint venture with a friend of mine who owned another studio where we made up what's called production music or jingle music. This is sort of cheap music that you use for industrial films, low-budget television, or commercials. But all of it at the same time, all the revenues were moving southward. We're going down across the board. So I had to do some rethinking. So one of the first things I did was get back involved in sort of, I was a mathematician by training, and I also did computer program and all the involved in technology. So I started advising and consulting in kind of the technology startup world and, you know, had a number of successes there. And at the same, sort of around that same time, the opportunity came up for a single semester to teach in the business college, sort of about the fundamentals of business, the things that you might get in an MBA degree, management, economics, entrepreneurship, all these sort of things were kind of in my wheelhouse, and I could kind of apply those concepts to the music business. So this was really the perfect course for me to teach. And so I started teaching it and I found I liked it. And so the university gradually made room for me to teach more classes until I became a full-time lecturer and then now a senior lecturer.
Do your students even know about your musical career?
Yes, they do. Some of them are aware of it directly from their own interests, but mostly I have this story that repeats itself over and over again towards the end of the semester. I'll see a student or two come into class and they will either have CDs or vinyl that I made. And then after the class, they come up to me and they ask me to autograph them for their parents.
That is awesome.
And this semester, I had my first grandparent. But hey, it's sort of great and wonderful.
Yeah, I also think still that you're the only professor at UGA who actually gets students who ask them for autographs. So I mean, even if it's for their parents or grandparents.
Yes, it may be. But you know, what a wonderful thing to teach at the university. What a great intellectual exercise to be able to sort of occasionally design your own course or just do research and things that you want. In a way, the freedom and the creativity of that, not always, I know, sometimes other people design courses, we have to teach other people's courses and stuff like that. But it's familiar to me because of the way like recording or songwriting contracts work, which is basically, here's a lump of money, now go and create some stuff and come back to us in 6 months or a year or something like that. You can still lose these contracts, but you still have this sort of freedom to pursue things.
So you teach about the music industry. In more recent years, you have particularly taken on the streaming industry. Is there anything specific about the music industry, or is it just general capitalism? And in what way has the streaming industry changed the music industry?
Well, that's interesting to talk about. So first of all, I was sympathetic to a number of the music tech sort of startups and the way things were arranged. In fact, I would say in the early 2000s when Napster came out, I thought, what a wonderful way to distribute your music. Yeah, I know I'm not going to get the same royalties that I did. If I was a record company, I would be very, very concerned about this. But hey, you know, look, I can sort of distribute my music and maybe there's some other way for me to make money directly from our fans, right? And that this will all work out for us, right? But very slowly over the next 5 or 6 years, what I realized was this sort of lack of enforcement on the rights of authors, largely copyrights, was slowly building these monopolies that would rival the major multinational record labels and in fact pay us less. And I can't take credit for being the person who really realized this and led the charge because it only dawned on me slowly over a number of years. In 2006, I was still like, oh, I'm going to make a new solo record. I'll just release it onto YouTube since that's where everybody seems to be listening to music now, right? So it's like one of those fluorescent lights with a bad ballast that just can't quite come on. So after like maybe 10 years, I realized that, look, this is not working out for us. But I was optimistic at first. And so as I dug into it, I realized there was a number of things. You know, basically the major digital platforms are given sort of a safe harbor from being sued for copyright infringement. So this basically lets YouTube pay a terrible rate. And then the streaming services themselves are an odd combination of Wild West VC capital and misguided essential nationalization of songwriter copyrights, because songwriters in the digital realm, streaming services, get the rights to use songwriter songs through a federal compulsory license, whereby we are obliged to license to them as long as they follow the correct procedure. And this is copied in basically every industrialized economy. But at the same time, the rates are set by this curious institution called the Copyright Royalty Board. And as we see in the West, almost always, these institutions get captured by the industries that they're essentially trying to regulate. So the rates for songwriters have been set extraordinarily low. And so you have this combination of these Wild West sort of VC-funded startups that don't really seem to have to make a profit. And then they, a lot of times, fundamentally rely on these licenses from the federal government where they've set our rates really low. So you're not only fighting these companies, you're also fighting the deep state, maybe is a good way of phrasing it, of the bureaucrats and the lawyers and the administrative judges in these positions who've kind of just grown up on this sort of view you know, their view is we're providing cheap music to consumers while ignoring the fact that by having that attitude, they're essentially building these enormous monopolies that are really hard for musicians to ever really fight. So I sued Spotify as a class action because even with those compulsory licenses, they neglected to follow the rules, one of which is being paying the songwriters the songs that you're using. And so that's what my lawsuit's about.
This reminds me of the first time I contacted you, which is a long time ago because I got COVID. But your first response to me was, well, I'm not that radical as your guest. And I think from what I've seen from your interviews, and from your tweet is that you're kind of a libertarian. In what way does your experience with the music industry and streaming companies and the way that they work together with the state, has that affected your views of politics in general, or was it in line with it?
If I'm a libertarian, it's on a very narrow range of topics. So I feel like I've occupied the same spot on the political spectrum for almost my entire adult life. Sometimes when I talk about things, other academics or other musicians involved in this fight will refer to me as an insult, a neoliberal, and I'm sort of like, yeah, maybe. I'm not across the board opposed to the state intervening in the economy. I would actually very much like to see the United States adopt a kind of safety net that is more like what you have in Northern Europe. But I very much think that the music business functions pretty well in a market way. And as long as we don't do these regulations that unfairly empower the digital platforms, I'm fine with markets. And in fact, especially with culture, where you see that there has actually been many sort of attempts over the years, most notably in France, to try to sort of have some state-funded cultural economies. It didn't really work out very well. But I think in general, musicians creatively and for freedom of expression reasons, I think we've done better with basically private funding of our cultural economy, right? Books, movies, music, television. And I wonder if we replace those with some state institutions to, you know, create music. I wonder how something like NWA's Straight Out of Compton, would that have been funded by the state? Probably not likely. So you have, you know, seminal hip hop records. I think that would have taken a number of years to have ever been funded by some sort of state institution. So I very much prefer the free markets for creating culture. But that, again, that's where, like, a lot of my musician friends, like, damn it, you're such a neoliberal. But this comes from my non-native populism. All this is tied to the non-native populace that I think I've settled in that place for a long time. And that used to be the province of the left, you know, sort of blue collar labor stuff, you know, the non-progressive labor party was once where I am. But I think that's kind of died out.
Although I'm a social democrat myself, I'm not sure how non-nativist the labor unions were in the 70s.
Oh, well, yeah. No. I agree. I totally agree with you about that. I'm saying I'm slapping a non-nativist thing onto that.
Finally, what is the greatest misunderstanding about the music industry?
I think the biggest thing is that popular musicians make a lot of money. There is a very narrow, the very upper part of the music business is extraordinarily wealthy. And streaming, because of the flat fee, you know, every song gets the exact same rate per stream. I have to work this out, but I think it overpays the top and underpays the middle and the bottom. So I guess the biggest thing about music business is that a lot of musicians that people regard as popular are actually really living a very middle class lifestyle. And we don't actually make that much money. It's decidedly unglamorous.
That's funny because to a certain extent, that's the same for sports business.
Exactly.
Like, and we always think about Messi or the big earners, whereas actually the vast majority of even so-called professional athletes have a pretty middle-class life.
Yes, that's particularly true in baseball and That's a good point. I'm going to think about that some more. I'm going to borrow that from you, Cass.
So thank you very much for coming on the show, David.
Thank you for having me.
If you want to know more about David Lowery and his many projects, go to his website, www.davidlowerymusic.com, or you can follow him on Twitter at David C. Lowery. This was another episode of Radical, the podcast on the radical aspects of music, politics, and sports, hosted by me, Cas Mudde. The music is from The Gonads with their classic song Karl Marx Supported Millwall. I want to thank Tarek Sidik for helping me with the editing of today's episode. If you want to know more about Radical, visit our website at www.radicalpodcast.com. Radical spelled R-A-D-I-K-A-A-L. And if you like the podcast, please rate and subscribe. Also, please share it with friends and on social media. Thank you for listening.
The economy is crumbling. They say it's at its day. The workers are all rumbling. Revolution's on the way. But I could never be a Marxist. It goes against the grain. And before you call me past it, give me a chance to explain. You say, come up to Port Newell. He went with Daddy Baker. See you silly disco songs and reading Melody Maker. I'm seeing Dan at Dunker playing with his beard. No wonder that Cass Capital turned out a little weird.